So at the end of the last session, we were asking ourselves and reflecting on, are we in bondage? Why, if I am, why? Or looking at another way, why aren't I free? Why aren't I enlightened? What's the problem? Because if we don't see the problem, why walk the path? So it needs to be kind of clear to us. So now in pairs, for 10 minutes, I'd like you to share why you think you are, or not, in bondage. Why would you walk this journey? Why? What is keeping me pinned down? Some of the examples they give, you know, it's like being a prisoner in a desert, bound by heavy ropes, totally bound. You can think like that if you like. I want to know what you think those ropes are. What's keeping you here? What's keeping you in this state? Why aren't you free? Okay? 10 minutes in pairs and one set of three, of course. Am I free? Am I not free? I'm in bondage. What's keeping me here? Why am I not enlightened? Why do I have to walk this path? What's going on? So, small questions, obviously. Easy answers. No trouble. 10 minutes, more than enough, eh? Never. Never. Who would like to feedback on that?
Well, for me, it was having a cluttered mind. You know, no space to just rest in.
Right.
And that process, in going down the path, it started to create a little bit of space occasionally.
Okay. I think that seems reasonable to me. Almost inherently we feel, don't we, that there's too much going on. My mind's cluttered. And we seem to have peace when it's... the brief moments we have when it's not cluttered. And we want more of that. So there's something about having that kind of peaceful, uncluttered mind that draws you, you know. And not having it, having a cluttered mind, seems to keep you tied down. Does that feel...
Yes, I can sort of narrow things a bit.
Narrowing,
as well,
yes.
Which
is like no freedom.
Just didn't feel right.
Okay.
It strikes me, as you were saying it, that what you actually need is a taste of the uncluttered mind, because without that first taste,
yes,
you don't know what you're missing, sort of thing.
Yeah. And yet, I mean, that's true. And especially if you can get into a habit of touching that mind, because there's nothing teaches you more than experience. You can listen to all the great teachers, you can listen to all the tapes, you can watch all the videos you want, but nothing beats having a taste of an uncluttered mind. Nothing. Sometimes in life, though, certain things happen. Sometimes it's a catastrophic event. Sometimes it comes out of the blue when things seem to stop and you have that space. And then the world starts again. Something starts. So if you've ever had experiences like that, you know that your mind's capable of it. I mean, it's capable of it, but you're right, there's nothing like tasting it. Nothing like tasting it. And then if you can draw upon it at will, how wonderful. How wonderful is that? Yeah.
For me, I think I have had experiences like that have been so intense that it's made me fearful.
Oh, right.
That place, in a way.
Right.
So I think my natural tendency is towards kind of floating off somewhere. So actually I like the kind of feeling of being more bound and grounded.
Right.
It helps me feel more here and more present.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a kind of like a fear of dissolution or something. It's so intense that it's like I don't know where or who I am anymore. So
very legitimate.
It makes
very
me
legitimate.
Anxious.
Yes. Yes. And we do know people that come and start meditating, and as soon as they get a taste of it, they stop. They don't like it. They don't like that idea. They feel as if they don't know where they're going. That happens. That can happen. It's not permanent. It's a shake up. It's like a shock. It's like a mind shock. Now, some people react to mind shock, to any sort of shock, by totally distancing themselves. What the Lam Rim is asking you to be is a bit more curious. Why is that happening? I mean, even if you're floating off, you're not going to float off. You know, I guarantee you'll not be floating off anywhere else. And I guarantee that your mind will come back and be just as cluttered you know, as it was when it started. So, but fear is real. Fear is real, and that can be, certainly. But the Lam Rim is asking you to face that, really. It's not going to kill you. It'll be fine. But I can understand. And I've had people really start meditating and then stop. They didn't like where they were going. Far better to have a lot of things busy. It's like it's almost an internal feeling of people who like to keep busy continuously. Always have something to do. Always have something to look forward to. Always going with, you know, physically. It's like that mentally. And that's where their home is. And you can understand that lifetime after lifetime. Again, thinking big, thinking wide. Taking reincarnation and beginning this mind. We've had lifetime after lifetime after lifetime behaving in this way, thinking in this way. Anything that shocks that is going to be a wee bit disturbing. But the Lam Rim is saying, face it. Really, face it. See what's going to happen. What's the worst that could happen? You get a bit annoyed, that's it. That's all. So, to walk this path, I think, has got to be courageous. I think you've got to be courageous, because not only are walking this path, again, walking this path is more, it's really 90% mental, really. I mean, physical actions, of course, are involved. I mean, it has to be. But really, it's a mental journey. But you have to be courageous, because if other people see what you're doing and they start questioning you, you're going against the norm. People don't like that. Yeah. But also, you're going against your own internal norm. And then fear arises. So you have to be a wee bit courageous, I think. Yeah. But fear, that's normal. That's a normal thing.
What you were talking about earlier on before we broke was actually what I meditated or what came up for me this morning in my personal practice.
All right.
Because I like to look at things head on. So I looked at what was behind the fear and the anger and the triggers that make me reactionary instead of being present.
Okay.
And what came up, which was powerful but simple, was self-love. Mm. Because I felt a lot of abandonment in my life. Mm. So that made me quite emotional, actually, because I know where that all comes from.
And
that's really, you know, that's the crux of what it's about.
Of course. Of course.
Self-love.
And this is important.
Not needing anybody else's love. That craving of other people's love.
Craving for other people's love. Okay.
I realised that, you know, that trigger of if people act in a certain way and I don't like it and I would be reactionary was on some level feeling of self-protection, but it wasn't. It was about not having love from other people that I need to give to myself.
Okay. No, I can see that. I mean that's. I mean, I think it, on some level we all have something like this.
Yeah.
I mean, we really crave it. We really like it. Mm. Yes. Spend a lot of time trying to get that. Mm. Okay. Was there anything that came up for you just now in discussion about how, you know, if you were in bondage at all? Is it emotional bondage you feel? It comes across like
it's
that.
It's emotional and mental. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah. Thank you. Why are you still here? Why aren't you floating out there? And why? Not at all. Not at all.
We all agreed that we're not free. We're not free, and that's why we're here. Because we're kind of looking for answers. Sometimes we find it difficult to find what the questions are. But often we're here because we want to be happy. And in our general lives, we're constantly trying to find happiness, and sometimes we don't look in the right places. We find little sticky plasters to try and just keep us going. But we all recognise that we're definitely not free.
So that's good. That's crucial. That is crucial. And anything that... So there's things that are keeping you not free. Mm-hmm. Searching after temporary happiness, is that right?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Then finding it doesn't work for very long?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And then still running after it?
Yeah.
No, really. I mean, we just don't learn, do we?
No.
The great Shantideva said that. No. Knowing what causes suffering, we keep running towards it. I'm paraphrasing, but knowing what causes suffering, I mean, we're not stupid, come on. We know what causes us suffering. But we keep running after it. all the time, mentally, that's what we do. It's a mental equivalent of saying, fire, put my arm in, ouch, ooh, ooh. If I put my arm again, in the, will it hurt? I'm not sure. Now imagine doing that lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. You'd lock that person up, eh? I mean, this person's no fit to be left alone. But we're locking ourselves up. That's one of the bonds that keeps us there. Definitely. Definitely. Habit. Very hard to break a habit. A habit in this lifetime is hard to break. Imagine a habit that you've had lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. You think giving up smoking is difficult? What? Nothing. Nothing compared. We think drugs and all the rest of it would be difficult. A habit in this lifetime tends to relate to habits in previous lifetimes. Tends to. How's that tendency? Anything else?
Well, this is just a bit similar, really. We just said the sheer force of old habits.
Yes.
That seem to have some be similar to addictions on a spectrum,
yes.
Small and large addictions, and how there seems to be such an addiction to negativity. Negative thought patterns.
That's true. That's true.
Judgmental.
Yeah.
Yeah, judging ourselves, judging the environment, judging the politicians, judging us.
Yeah.
Others, judging.
Yeah. That's
certainly. One's got to have kind of like an opinion, and quite often a negative one.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Because, I mean, one of the great Kagyu Lamas said, judging others is samsara. That's what they said. Judging others is samsara. But the good news, I think, is we always like to have the good news, eh?
Yeah.
So, but the good news is, remember His Holiness talking about it, the question is not why we judge others and why we suffer. I'm paraphrasing again. The real interesting thing is, why is it that instinctively we recognise evil? Instinctively we recoil at evil. We want to prevent people being hurt. I think he was almost saying, it's almost like, although all this is going on and we're very active in this judging, underneath that there seems to be something that recognises evil and is repulsed by it. That recognises people's suffering as being, you know, just awful, just has to be avoided. When we saw, if you imagine all the great things that have happened in the world, you know, really negative things, the Twin Towers and Grenville and all the rest of it, the initial reaction from people, the initial reaction, not in a few minutes, the first thing was, oh my Lord, that's awful, poor things, you know. The initial reaction is compassion. It tends to be. And it's a very, imagine watching Grenville. And in that moment, you're sitting with someone who says, yeah, well, they should have sorted that cladding out years ago. What? That type of thing comes later. Hey. Mm-hmm. The first thing that comes to your mind, oh, my Lord, those poor people. I mean, really, those poor people. So what's interesting to when His Holiness was talking about it was, is although we have all these judgments and negativities, underneath all that, our first response to something tragedy is often compassion. Then something else kicks in, and you kind of keep the compassion, but it gets kind of less, and it's all judgment and things like this. And sometimes to live in the world, you need a bit of judgment. But this compassion is what's interesting. Why is that almost a default position for most people? And the Dharma is very clear about it. It's because it's our nature. It's part of our Buddha nature. Our compassion and our wisdom is there. You do not have to learn it. It's already there, but it's clouded by past habits, past concepts. But sometimes when something, and it's all this layer after layer and concepts and judgments, but something, when something, a huge tragedy occurs, it's almost like it goes through all those layers and hits you, who you really are. Otherwise, why would you respond with compassion? So although all this judgment is going, that's absolutely sure. But your Buddha nature, that's in every single sentient being, is there. And it's pristine. it's pristine. From the Galupa, you talk about a potential, Buddha potential. But if you don't want to get into potential or not, you can look at Buddha nature. It is your nature to be like that. And all sentient beings have it. But it's clouded, obscured. So a lot of what we do is really getting rid of this and finding what's already there. But to get rid of this, you need to kind of reprogram this nonsense. And this is where the Lam Rim comes. So it's true how we behave. Lifetime after life, very difficult. And sometimes you're in the middle of it. I don't know if you've ever found this. You're going, ah, you know, right. And you kind of reprogram what you're going to say.
Yeah.
You know, this is what happens. But what happens with Lam Rim is that comes earlier and earlier and earlier. Maybe with some people who are ripe, it just is, once they understand what's going on, it never happens again. Or you get people like me that are plodders. I plod along the Dharma path. And what happens is you recognise that earlier and you stop yourself earlier and earlier and earlier. You stop yourself physically, then you stop yourself verbally, and then you loosen it in your mind until you can catch the thought rising before anything else happens. And that's let go. And as you progress, the thought doesn't even arise. All that couldn't happen if you didn't have the potential within you. Couldn't happen. So, anyway, good. Anything else?
The other thing I thought of was always thinking of the past or the future.
Uh-huh.
On a fairly constant basis, rather than just being in the present. And because thinking past and future, we then create all these stories and then we elaborate on them and all sorts of things, and it affects the way we connect with others as well as ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a constant.
It is constant, that's right. I mean, to work in this world, to live in and abide in this world, you kind of need to know your history. You need to have something to aim towards. I think that's reasonable. But you don't have to believe in it. It's not so much, I think, having thoughts, ideas and emotions and projecting. I mean, obviously, in certain practices that you wouldn't be doing this. In other practices, you do it. It's a tool. And if you're living in the world and you're behaving and you're trying to benefit people that think like this, of course, you're going to have your history, you're going to be thinking past, you're going to be projecting into the future, right? Because otherwise, difficult to live. Unless you're a nun and a monk on top of a mountain, you know, with somebody to feed you and look after you and do your ironing and blah, 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 you know. Otherwise, if you have to interact in the world, then you have to. It's important to engage with people. And so concepts are quite important. There'll come a time in meditation when concepts just start disappearing. And in the end, the concepts give way to direct perception. And when you have direct perception, no need to go into the past and project into the future. Is it good to do these things? I don't know. Sometimes I think it's useful. Most times not. Most times it's just a fantasy, which you enhance and elaborate until it becomes a reality. And this is the habit over many lifetimes. So I suppose what I'm saying is, to live in this world, you have to do a wee bit. But what you don't have to do is to believe in any of it. Just don't believe in it. We believe in so much, and it's nonsense. You have to enact in a certain way. And there'll be times you're in one situation, you don't have to do that. You'll be in another situation. Choose when to do it. Don't make it a habit. And whatever you do, believe none of it. It is an illusion. What we think is real, not real. It's an illusion. Believe nothing. Query everything. Absolutely everything. It's great. What do you know? Nothing. You know, but our opposite is what we think we should be doing. I should know this, 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 and this. And in one situation, that's right. That's helpful. You wouldn't want someone leading a meditation class on Lam Rim who'd never even heard of Lam Rim, couldn't spell Lam Rim, would you? You'd need somebody there. So it's useful. You don't have to believe in all of it. What you have to do is experience it. You have to experience it.
To me, it's also the motivation behind it.
Everything is. That's the that's very profound.
I think that's the key.
Yes. Motivation is absolutely key. And motivation on many, many levels. Everything that we learn today or whatever, it's like an onion, you know. It's all these different layers. We call it one thing, but as it becomes subtler and subtler and subtler, it almost becomes something else. And that's true with motivation. We think of motivation as, right, I am going to do this, that, and the next thing. But we know we don't always say that. Sometimes we think it. And sometimes we think about it much lighter. And the motivation's still there. And sometimes it's just an urge. That moment before thought, that moment before action. Yes. Thank you. Anything else? Why we're still in bondage.
I was saying, like, you know, if there's a difficult situation or an unpleasant situation, there's this tendency to just think only about your suffering, and this creates immense bondage.
Yes.
You just become obsessed with how you're feeling, how you're reacting, instead of it, and this teaching that you will be happy if you cherish others before yourself.
It sounds so counterintuitive, doesn't it?
Yeah. But I have sort of tried it, you know, a little bit, and you do notice the difference when you make an effort, at least, to think about how these other, how everyone else is feeling and suffering, and that lightens that.
People are so important, we don't realise. We think we're important compared to others. In the Dharma, you learn other people are far more important. You see?
Yeah.
And we'll come to that later. It's not that we're beating ourselves up going, oh, I'm not worthy, I am not. No, you're very worthy. But other people, very important, really important. When that becomes clear. And again, if you want that feeling to become stronger, then you listen to teachings, you reflect, you study, you meditate, analytically and single-pointed, and begin to change the mind. Because as long as we keep cherishing ourselves, which is the source of everything, all our problems are here. If we keep doing that, think how tight that is, how limiting. The Dharma's not like that. The Dharma's like that. And it's not just, oh, well, that sounds nice, but it doesn't work. Really? Try it. It works. It works. Okay. So I'd like you now just to posture, get yourself in a nice posture. Do the two-breath meditation as I explained before, breathing in through the nostrils, allowing the belly to fill, and then out through pursed lips on a long out-breath. And on that long out-breath, just let your whole body relax. Do that twice, and then breathe normally. And we reflect on what people have been saying here about being in bondage, not being free, not being enlightened, bringing to mind perhaps your main point of why you're not enlightened. Bring it to mind now. The Buddha Dharma is very clear about why we are not enlightened. It is not peculiar to ourselves or to the times we live in. It was true in Buddha's time, and it's true now. And the first point is we have a strong habit from beginningless lifetimes of not understanding the suffering of ourselves and others, not understanding suffering of ourselves and others, having no clear understanding of it. Just consider that point. Even if it's confusing to you, still consider, do I really not understand the suffering of myself and others? The Dharma is saying, really, we don't understand. We see only superficial. The second point, as true in Buddha's time as it is now, the situation we call happiness is actually suffering. And another way of saying that is we believe suffering is happiness. And you can think to yourself, well, that's nonsense. But is it worth investigating what the Buddha said? We mistake suffering and label it happiness. What could that possibly mean? The other reason we're still in bondage is we have a habit of seeing disturbing emotions, all forms of emotions, disturbing emotions, as pure and permanent. And the nighness of it all is we are ignorant, and by this I mean we totally misknow who we are, who others are, and the nature of all phenomena around us. We misknow ourselves and others. And the major way that we misknow ourselves and others is that we see ourselves and others and all phenomena as having something within it which is the essence, which is permanent, unchanging. We see, in Dharma speak, things as having a self, this permanent, unchanging entity, in and of itself, there, within ourselves. There's something intrinsically that's me, which is permanent and unchanging. Something in others that is permanent and unchanging. All phenomena around us as having something within it which is permanent and unchanging. That's the biggest ignorance of all. To tackle that, it's important to make a lifelong study of the true nature of our minds. It's vital. And to do that, we need to reveal to ourselves, when I think of mind, what do I think of? So right here and now, just think of three things that you know or believe or you think are true about mind, my mind. I'm not going to ask you to reveal it, but I would ask you to jot it down. If an alien was to say to you, what do you mean by mind? You say? When it's clear to you, just make a jot. So, all of the study of the Buddha Dharma is grounded in understanding consciousness. Grounded in it. Grounded in its understanding of its nature, its function, its ability to transform unhappiness into happiness. It's grounded in that. His Holiness the Dalai Lama often says there are two main reasons to study the mind. Two main reasons. One, because of its intimate nature, its intimate connection with karma. Right? That alone makes it worth studying. But secondly, the mind is crucial in our experience of happiness and unhappiness. Crucial. For those two reasons alone, the mind is worth exploring. Because His Holiness says, all living beings want to be happy. All living beings want to avoid unhappiness, without question. Whoever you're looking at in the world, whatever animal you see, whatever spirit you encounter, we think we've got nothing in common. We have everything in common. Because just like you, they want to avoid suffering. Just like you, they want to be happy. And so, because of its intimate nature and its intimate connection with karma, study mind. Because it's crucial in our happiness and unhappiness, we must study mind. Lama Yeshe says, when we study Buddhism, Lama Thubten Yeshe, when we study mind, what we're really studying is ourselves. That's really what we're studying. When we're studying Buddha Dharma, we're really studying ourselves. We're exploring our own mind about how to be healthy, how to be peaceful. And really this study has got to be about wisdom. It's got to be about knowledge and wisdom. It's not got to be about dogma. Very clearly. Because the Dharma is very clear, the Buddha Dharma is very clear. Our existence, just take this world, our existence in this world and our experiences within this world, from the Buddha Dharma point of view, does not come about by a creator God. That's not in there. Do gods exist? Oh yes, different realms of existence. But a creator God, from the Buddha Dharma point of view, no. Our existence and our experience within this existence, according to the Dharma, does not come about through anything random. It doesn't come about through anything chaotic. It really comes around and comes into being because of our mental, physical, verbal exchanges with reality. Our mental, physical, verbal interchanges with reality. We create our reality. We create our existence and we create our experiences within this existence. The closest the Dharma has to a creator principle is karma. That's the closest. And this is important to understand for many reasons. If we are the creator of the situation, then it becomes clear that we're actually the creator of our happiness, yeah? It may be, the premise is clear. And often, if you say that to people, they go, yes, I know, I'm quite happy with being the creator of my happiness. I can see that. I'm really clear about what makes me happy. It's not a problem. And you say, well, I'm so pleased. Because if you're the creator of your own happiness, you're also the creator of your own unhappiness. Ooh, don't know about that. Not keen on that. But it comes about. That's how it comes about. No blaming a creator God. And as Rabina, Venerable Rabina would say, no blaming mummy and daddy. No blaming this. No. Ooh. Right. Okay. Interesting. Because we're the creator of our happiness and unhappiness, what the Dharma says, you're creating it within an illusion, really. You're creating it within a totally suffering situation. And so any happiness that arises, that you label happiness, tends to be temporary, tends to be limited, tends to be unsatisfactory, and above all, tends to be illusory. Because this is where it's created within, it's tainted. It's tainted. So that's where the Dharma's coming from. We create it. Am I happy sometimes in this life? Of course I am. If I look into it too deeply, I'm not quite sure. But generally speaking, on a surface level, have I been happy? Well, yeah, there's been times. But the Dharma says it was temporary, was it? Was it limited? Was it ultimately unsatisfactory? And was it illusory? This path is leading you out of that. Because your Buddha nature, this potential you have within you, this Buddha nature, if you can touch that, and how you touch that is with your mind, decluttering your mind, touching that, then the happiness you get will not be illusory. It will not be unsatisfactory. It will not be limited. and it will not be temporary. That's your heritage, but we don't know it. The Dharma tries to make that really clear. This is your heritage. This is what you can achieve. Will it be difficult? Absolutely. Because of lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. Even if we have an idea of that, we tend to still think in this one lifetime, right? Well, this happened to me and that happened to me and this happened to me. Always blaming externals. Always. This is what I'm saying. It's so challenging. It's actually saying you are the author of your own happiness and unhappiness. But the good news is, if you're the opposite, you can choose. But how do I choose? Walk the path. Walk the Dharma path. You'll see signposts along the way that are indicating you're on the right track. You will become happier. It will last longer. The indications will be all over the place if you look for them. If you look for them, they're all over the place. Buddhism is often called, Lama Yeshe used to call it the science of the mind. Science of the mind. It's really all about mind. And many people argue that Buddhism isn't even a religion. I can go with that. It really is about mind. And that's not cold and calculating. That's warm and compassionate and wise. So again, just think. Now make it really personal to yourself. Just think. When was I last really happy? When did I last feel truly happy? What was going on? When was it? And why did I feel happy? Bring the whole situation to your mind and start to taste it. And ask yourself, how satisfactory was that? How long did it last? What were the limitations? How real was it? Was there an illusory factor there? Thank you. So would anyone like to say what was going on? I mean, I don't need a blow-by-blow description, but using the criteria we were looking at, was it easy to find a moment of happiness? That's the first question. Some people, yes? Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How long did that moment last? Did that happiness bubble last? Being honest now, you see, these are the type of questions we don't ask. We need to say to ourselves, how long did that last? What do you think?
Not long.
Not long?
Well, moments pass all the time. So
did it taper off or just suddenly go? Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah? Lessened in intensity, perhaps?
Yeah.
And became...
Yeah.
Okay. Anyone else?
I mean, for me, it was just a moment. That's when my daughters were born.
Mm-hmm.
So it is. They can't be born every day. So
then they cause trouble.
Yeah, it was just that moment.
And it's useful to have those moments, isn't it? Because it shows you what may be possible. What else was just generally? What else was making you happy? What was making you happy? What was going on? What was happening? Just generally.
For me, it was taking my mum out on Mother's Day because she doesn't usually let me.
Right. Okay.
Take her out.
Right.
Sort of like a glow of seeing her happy.
Yes. Yeah. Good. Mm. Excellent. You'd think everybody would be able to shout this out at me, what made them happy, but you're all going, I don't know, she doesn't ask me. I want you to think about this. Mostly what we come up with, because I ask myself the same question, right? Mostly what we come up with is something that's external to us. Another person, an external situation, praise, approbation, finding something, getting something, seems to be something external to us. And this is our habit. This is our habit, is seeing that which is external as the cause of our happiness.
Yeah.
It's dangerous. It's a dangerous way to think. Why is it dangerous? Well, first of all, it's not true, but let's just put that to one side. If you are investing mentally, thinking that my source of happiness is external to me, what do you do to get more happiness? Makes sense, doesn't it? If I see the source of my happiness, and you know, really this is what it's talking about. If we see the source of our happiness as external to us, then it makes sense that you go outwards to achieve happiness. What's the Dharma saying? The Dharma is saying the opposite. The Dharma is saying the source of your happiness is not out there. It's in here.
Yeah.
Now, this is a big sea change. If you actually start to understand that and believe it, whoa, will you keep going this way? Or will you go inward? You'll go inward. Makes sense. I want more happiness. Seems reasonable to me. I like to be happy. So it seems to me that if I want more happiness and I understand that the source of happiness is internal, I will go internal. I will go to the source, I'll go to my mind. So that's one thing. You start going, well, okay, but other people can make you happy. Well, other people can contribute to a situation where happiness can arise, certainly. There is an effect, of course, but it is not the source. There's where we make our mistake. It is not the source. But we are taking contributing factors as being the pinnacle, as being the reason. And then it makes sense. If my family make me happy, I will do more for my family. If my children make me happy, that's where I'll focus. If my husband or wife makes me happy, that's where I... If my job If earning a lot of money makes me happiness, that's what I'm, you know, it's all external. This, we have to kind of look at this really closely. Does it have an effect? Of course it has an effect, but it's not the main effect. The cause is internal, always. And so Dharma is not about this, although there are external things you do in the Dharma for sure, but really it's an internal journey. And here's the other thing the Dharma says. If you're investing your source of happiness in that person, and how many times have you said or heard people say, if they're happy, I'm happy? What a nonsense, really. But we say it, and if we don't say it, we think it. And you know, everybody around will go, that's really nice. There's a compassionate person. There's a nice... They don't think about themselves. They think about others. That's wonderful. To a Dharma practitioner, you're going, really? You will be happy if they're happy?
Yeah.
So their happiness or unhappiness plays your mind like a yo-yo? That's how you want to live? That's how you think living is? No. The source of your unhappiness is internal. But we seem to invest, we invest people as a source of our happiness. And if they're happy, we're happy. And if all these things they're giving me, but especially people who are close to you, either in work or family, if they're unhappy, I'm miserable. I'm absolutely miserable. How could you be happy if they're miserable? You bad person, you. You selfish person. Really? You're actually investing this external group of people with the fact that you're going to be happy or unhappy. I mean, it doesn't sound reasonable, does it?
It's very hard, though, isn't it?
Like, of course.
Someone in your family is suffering.
Oh, yes. But I'm not saying you mustn't be compassionate. Mm. I'm not saying you wouldn't help. Of course you do. But I'll tell you, a reasonable mind can help someone far better than someone who's allowed their emotions to become unhappy because you're unhappy. This person can't help you. Mm-hmm. They're in the same situation you're in. If you want help, you go to someone that can help you, who has better knowledge, better understanding. Yes? You don't want someone that's in the same boat as you. You can sympathise, of course. You can even have tears. That's emotional, and there's nothing wrong with that. But that's not happiness or unhappiness. That's giving people what they need at that moment. Being compassionate, being wise, that comes from a stable mind. It comes from a valid mind. And a valid mind is the only basis for true happiness. The only basis. But we mistake being in control of our happiness and unhappiness with being cold and unfeeling. The opposite is true. The opposite is true. But see how big this is? It's huge. And this is just the beginning. Just the beginning. These are the questions we have to ask ourselves. These are the assumptions which you never ever address. We never do it. But we've got to do it. We've got to deprogram ourselves. Not let other people do it. Because they're programming you. I mean, children program their mothers, no problem, and their fathers. And then as they get older, I've noticed that the parents programming their children through guilt and all the rest of it. I mean, it's easy done. Being in charge and understanding you're in charge of your own happiness and heart makes you far more effective, makes you far more compassionate, far more wise, and able to help other people. This is what the Dharma says. And yet mind, the idea of mind is very difficult for people to get. I mean, there's libraries full of stuff on the mind. But even scientists, if you listen to them, they'll say, well, there's lots of things about it now, but many scientists will say the mind doesn't exist. Stephen Hawking once said that the mind is that which is vomited up by the brain. They don't see the difference. That which is vomited up by the brain. There's no consensus of understanding. People are beginning to look into it now, but still no consensus of what mind is. And its relationship to the brain not understood. In the Dharma, they're very clear. Whether you believe it or not is totally up to you. But for 25 centuries, through wisdom, understanding, and experience, Buddhism is very clear what the mind is. And I always say this, but I was told that there was once in America, there was once a meeting of scientists and it was therapists who were all based psychiatry, you know, it was a big thing. And the question was asked, you know, to raise your hand, those who really understand know what the mind is. Nobody raised their hand. Nobody was sure. All had different ideas and thoughts. Some thought it was material, some thought it was not material. Some thought it didn't exist. When you start studying the Buddha Dharma, it's very clear. They have no difficulty in telling you what the mind is. So, let's have a wee look. I'd like you to just have a wee look at this. So here are the areas, at least for understanding the labyrinth, remembering that this study is vast. It's a vast study of the mind. But these are the main points we will have to get to. So I like this first one. The topic of mind is very subtle, and it's very difficult to talk about mind. Now, if His Holiness the Dalai Lama says it, I think that can be taken as a given, really. And it's extremely subtle. Extremely subtle. So a good way to start is having some sort of definition about mind. And the next thing with His Holiness is saying, the mind is an entity that has the nature of mere experience. Now, in the Dharma, when they use the word mere, they're very, very specific. It really means bare, with no additions. Right? It's mere. So it says, the mind is an entity that's nature of mere experience that is clarity and knowing. It is the knowing nature or agency that is called mind, and it is non-material. Now, when we start doing meditations on this, here's what we're looking at, is we're trying to touch this clarity of mind. Now, the clarity is the function of the mind, right? That's its function. That's its nature. Its nature is clarity. And when we're talking about clarity here, we're talking about non-material. We're talking space-like nature of consciousness. We're not talking about colour. We're not talking about shape or material dimensions. We are talking about that which cognizes, that which reflects, that which knows its object. Right? So this clarity, space-like clarity, is the nature of the consciousness. Its function is to know. That's its function, is to know. And it is the mere event of knowing, the mere event of knowing. So you could say that knowing is a subjective event. The mind of knowing arises in response to an object with it. The mind, the knowing arises within the object. Okay, so it's interdependent. It relies on, it's interdependent. The knowing of, interdependent. Mind is never static. Don't ever think it is. The mind is a dynamic process. Whatever we're engaged in, our dialogue, events, underneath it, because mind is involved, has to be involved, the nature of clarity in every event. In every event there's a nature of clarity. In every event there is a function of knowing. Everything. There's nothing that is not. Now, what we're talking about here is pristine mind. And we have to be clear about different. Within the Dharma they'll talk about, say, six minds. They're very clear. Six minds, right, okay. So basically you've got five conscious minds. So all your sense consciousness are also minds. But these minds are temporary. These sense consciousnesses are temporary. They arise independent upon the object of the sense. So the consciousness of smell does not arise unless there's something to smell. The consciousness of sight does not arise unless there's something to see, and so on. Then we talk about mental consciousness. And from now on, mental consciousness is mind. Although there are these minds, these are temporary. This is not temporary. Okay. This mind, consciousness, it can use and it can interact with all the objects of the five senses. But it does not rely on that object to develop, to arise. Okay? These minds, temporary, relies on objects. This mind can make use of this, but it functions in reliance upon a previous moment of mind. So mental consciousness, which is going to be synonymous from now on with mind, this is the mind we're talking about, is relying on previous moment of consciousness. So one moment of consciousness gives rise to the next moment of consciousness, gives rise to the next moment, and so on. Now, broadly speaking, if you see the mind like that, then where does the mind come from that you have now, this moment of mind? Imagine that. Where did it come from? Previous moment of mind, right? Where did that mind come from? Previous moment of mind. Now imagine someone asking that question on and on and on, and your response is previous moment of mind, previous moment of mind. And eventually they'll say, oh, come on, there must have been a beginning. The Dharma says, no, it doesn't have to be a beginning at all. How could there be a beginning? If one moment of mind gives rise to the next, how could there be a beginning? So what gives rise to our next moment of mind? This moment of mind gives rise to that. What does that give rise to? That. So imagine the same person saying, and what does that give rise to? And you say, that. And you keep going, and eventually what they're going to say, it has to stop somewhere. How can it? If one moment of mind gives rise to the next moment of mind, mental consciousness, right? How can it stop? How can there be an end?
Could you call that just the logic of cause and effect?
Not just, no, but I think it has something to do with it. Yeah, definitely. I mean, the law of cause and effect permeates everything. It permeates everything. You can see cause and effect in everything. We're not saying cause and effect is the same as karma. Right? We're not saying cause and effect is the same as karma. Is karma cause and effect? Yes. Is cause and effect karma? Not always. But we'll come to that. We'll come to that. So look already. This mind, this mental consciousness, which has no beginning, which has no end, whose nature is pristine, space-like nature of clarity, whose simple function is to know, and I'm not saying to know this, that, and the next thing, simply to know. You're trying to hit that. You're trying to hit that. Right? So why is it not clear to us? It's not clear to us because over and above all of that, superimposed or not, is all our emotions, all our past karmas, all our negativities, all our habits. It's like, it's really just completely, and then when we get it, we exaggerate it so much, and then we 100% believe that's the mind. So a lot of the Dharma is about freeing that. And if you can free yourself for those add-ons, and you can touch the mind, and you can stay with that mind, you have freedom. You have freedom. And it's possible. Why is it possible? It's possible because mind is a continuity, right? It's continuity. One moment, gives rise to the next. So in a way, you could say that's temporary. You could say that, couldn't you? Because one mind... But the continuum is not, right? The continuum, like a river. Everything else, the emotions, the disturbance, the fear, the anger, even the love and, you know, all the things we do, all of that is temporary. They're add-ons to the mind. They're additions. And because they're temporary additions, they can be got rid of. And a lot of the Lam Rim is about identifying these add-ons, which are doing nothing but obscuring who you really are, and therefore what you can do. It's about getting rid of them. And you can do it because it's not part of the nature of the mind. None of this is. None of our emotions and our emotional baggage. It's not part of the nature of the mind. Why? Because the nature of the mind is clarity. That's clarity. Underneath all of that is clarity. If you can reach that and you use that as your object, you're free. You could be free. Or at least you'll be well along the way. That's how important mind is. Now in the Dharma, when we talk about mind, we're talking about mental consciousness, right? Now, we're just talking about mental consciousness. But even that mental consciousness has different levels. Different levels. I mean, I'm not going to go into all of this because that's something you have to study, but just think about it. You have the... We're using mental consciousness now, right? Okay, we've got the baggage with it, but we're using it. You can call that gross mind, gross mental consciousness. Still carrying a lot of baggage with it. But it can become more subtle than that. And they say that the mind of dreaming is a more subtle mind. Okay? But the mind that goes from life to life is even more subtle than that. Even more subtle than that. It's the most subtle mind. Because at death, what happens is all the objects that give rise to the five sense consciousness shut down. That you can no longer see, hear, taste, touch. All of that's gone, right? So it's no longer clouding this. This in itself starts to become refined and refined until it reaches its more subtle level at the time of death. We'll go into that a bit more when we do death. But that's what goes to life to life. It's a huge thing. But I'm really just trying to give you an overview here. Any questions about that? Yeah, well, we'll have to meditate.
Okay. I don't know if this is a question or not, but this discussion of mind is, you know, I'm not trying to be rude, ultimately futile and pointless.
Oh, well, that's...
But there's no... That isn't a reason not to do it. Do you know what I mean?
Okay, no, but could you put it another way?
Right. It's... If you have mirrors facing each other and a candle between them, it just goes on forever, doesn't it? In principle.
Okay.
It goes on forever. And... Trying to, it's self-reflexive. We are not, I'm not saying this as a, it just seems to me, my emotional, we are not going to come to an answer, what is the nature of the mind, with the mind.
Ah, interesting, interesting. So how are you going to come to it?
I don't think you are. That's why I say it's ultimately futile. Ultimately.
Right.
That's not a reason not to do it.
Right.
So in that sense, the words futile and pointless are not the correct one.
No, but...
But we are going to do it, are we?
Okay. Right. Now, it's an excellent question. And it's something we need to reflect on a lot. But here's the tools to reflect on it with. The mind is not a single entity. It is not coloured. It has no dimension. Right? It pervades everything. We tend to think it's here, and there's my mind, okay? So how can that do that? How can it look at itself? You know, my fist, if my fist is my mind, I can't turn around and look at the back of my fist. What the hell is going on? It's like that. You can't mourn my... But if the mind has no dimension, no colour, no space, not material, it has aspects. So you can have what's called primary... I didn't want to go into it, but you can have primary minds and secondary minds, mental aspects, as well as the core mind. But really what I'm saying is this. It is absolute... What's been validated with experience through 25th century is that it's possible for one part of the mind to look at another part of the mind. It's absolutely possible. And this has been validated through various experiences. But you yourself can come to that with certain meditations, and we'll do some of them, see how we go with that. But here's the premise. One part of the mind can view another part of the mind. So the tool you're using is mind. What you're observing is mind. And this is possible because it's not a lump. It's not a single entity. It's not confined. It's spacious. It's not material. It's clarity. It knows. And the most important thing for the mind to know is itself. And once the mind knows itself, and you can hold that, you can hold that, you're well along the way. You're well along the way.
I think I see what you mean, and that's why I'm saying to myself that the words futile and pointless are not the correct ones.
It wouldn't be the first time I've been called futile and pointless.
No, no, no.
Would it work?
I'm not saying that. I don't want to hear these teachings. I think eventually we're up against.
You're up against something that's spacious, that has no material dimension, that is not coloured, that has no shape, that pervades every mental event. You're not up against.
Oh no, and therefore we're not going to get there, are we? We're not going to get there. I'm not going to get there.
Why not? Oh, come along. You can do
it. No. I mean, because I suppose really, this sounds a bit fancy, presumptuous, but there's nowhere to get to.
Okay. You see, in a very heavy philosophical discussion, you could get people that would agree with that, right? Because on one basis, you could actually say that is not an error. There is nowhere to get to because there's no dualism. There's no mind and where you're going. There's no me and mind. So at quite a high level, you could say that and you would be correct. It does not help getting there, though.
Saying there's nowhere to go doesn't help getting there. I absolutely agree with that.
No. So on one level, you could say there is nowhere to get. And if you say that from a non-dualistic point of view of us and them, me and that, you know, from a non-dualistic point of view, you're absolutely correct. But make sure you're speaking to someone who also has a non-dualistic view. Okay? Now, if you've got a dualistic view, which we all have at the moment, unless you're online, you have there's always us and them. All what the path's doing, meditation on the mind and all the lamrim, is closing that gap, that dualistic gap. Closing it, getting closer and closer, until there is no gap. That you and others, subject and object, are the same. And then, of course, where is there to go? Where is there that's not there? Nowhere. Does that help you get to that state? I don't think so. But maybe people who are prime, you know, really prime and are really in that high cognitive... Because, I mean, some philosophers, I mean, really are there. It would only need that for them to be quite happy and understand. For other people, it would just go back. And I'm in that category. The other way that I find quite useful of looking at mind And I'm spending a bit of time on mind here because it just underpins everything. Is we talk about living our life and how we imbue other people as the source of our happiness and unhappiness and judging and others. See, we're believing in a fantasy. See, I'm not saying that we don't exist. That's not true. We do exist. But we don't exist how we appear to exist. That's the problem. And it's being compared to going to a cinema. And when you're a child and you go to see an exciting film, you're there. You identify with the villain or the goodie or whatever. And, you know, you're just there. It's real. For there's a time when that is totally real. But it's only projections. It's only projections coming from a projector, isn't it? I remember going to see Avatar. Anybody here seen Avatar?
Yeah.
I saw it in a very big cinema. A friend took me. And I thought, oh, just like Dharma. Because I think everything's just like Dharma, you know. It's my default position, it's just like Dharma. Anyway, you can see people, and it was 3D. They were there. I mean, they were just, I mean, me too. You know, why I didn't have a tail and could fly, I have no idea. It's how we live our lives, you see. We mistake the projections for the screen of the mind. We see the cinematic view, and we believe 100%. That's the mind, that's real. And if you were to say to someone they'd never been to a cinema, but what's behind all that? Nothing. What do you mean? That's it there. And you slowly wind down the projector and the images become fainter and fainter and fainter and fainter. And then you turn it off and there's a screen. That's like the mind and the projections. The projections there are the five senses. What we conjured up with our five senses. Project on our mind and then believe that's real. We never look at what's behind all that. What the basis is. What the clarity, the knowing. And by subduing the five senses, this is where Buddhism gets to say, well, it's good to subdue the senses. It's not about flagellation and being miserable. And by the way, let's make everybody miserable with us. You know, it's actually the opposite to that. But it's not giving the power to the five senses that it thinks it should have. Because if you can calm these five senses down, you've got a chance for mental consciousness to come up and be online. At the moment, we use our mental consciousness mostly for commenting on the five senses. That's what we do. This mental consciousness, it goes from life to life to life to life. Yes, this really prime clarity and knowing. What do we give it to do? It's like having a PhD student and making them wash the dishes at university and not teach. You know, what is it doing? What it's doing is commenting on the five senses. That's what it's doing. And that's what we expect it to do. It's what we want it to do. Now imagine that you, through your meditation, you start to calm all these projections of the five senses, which is why you relax. Yeah? Just calm it all down. That's why you come inwards. Calm it all down. Calm the five senses. Then mental consciousness comes on like I always say, like a meerkat. You know, sometimes when you see a meerkat, it just goes like that. Suddenly, all this is calmed down and it comes online. Imagine what you can do with that mind that's not encumbered by this. And what it can do is it can know itself. It can know what's going on clearer and clearer and clearer and clearer. But eventually it can know itself. And these are what meditations on mind, this is what you study on the mind. And there's different ways of studying mind. There's philosophical ways, there's epistemological, psychology. There's all different ways of doing it. It all has it and it's quite involved. But really this is what it's going to. It's going to this. This clarity, this luminosity, this mere knowing cuts the bonds of karma. Cuts the bonds of karma. Cuts the bonds of samsara. All of it. Okay. Yeah, definitely meditate now. Definitely. So, could you get yourself into a nice posture? and check the points that we mentioned before, the back of the neck, the chin, the eyes, the tongue, the hands, the feet. Just go through it in your mind. Using the two-breath method, if that's useful, or another method, to simply relax the body while keeping the mind quite alert. Give the mind nothing else to do. Keep still. To examine the mind in this way is extremely important. It's far more important than investigating external objects. Why? Because the mind is the root, the source of our happiness. If our minds remain deluded and misknowing, no matter how successful we are, we will remain unhappy, and any happiness we have will be transitory. So it becomes particularly important to observe our own mind. Try to understand our own mind. And now, take a few minutes. Flood your mind. Observe your whole body. The breathing, the nostrils, the warmth, the texture, the mass of your body. Flood your mind with all the details of your own body. Your mind is now flooded with the texture and the warmth and the mass, and everything about your body. That's all you're focusing on. And in a moment, I want you to quickly, mentally step back and see that there is a mere knowing of all this, which is separate from that which is known. So flood your mind with every aspect of your body. Mentally step back and see that there's a knowing of this that's separate from what is known. So in your own time. Do this a few times. Just completely overload your mind with the feelings and the texture of your body. And then mentally step back into the knowing of it. as opposed to what's known. Now, once again, flood your mind, but this time, become aware, highly aware of everyone in this room. What they look like, what they sound like, shape, colour, texture, everything. Include all the objects in the room. Flood your mind. What are they? What do they do? What do they look like? Completely flood your mind with everything in this room and everyone in this room. When your mind is flooded, again, mentally step back and see that there's a mere knowing of this, which seems to be separate from what is known. Flood your mind again and repeat the process. Now imagine that you've got the idea of the knowing as separate from what is known. Stand beside this knowing aspect. And the next thought, idea or emotion that comes to mind, simply observe it from this knowing point of view. Simply observe it. What happens to it? The thought, the idea, the emotion. And sometimes when you say this, it's hard for anything to come to mind. And if that's the case, then imagine something and bring it to mind. Then take the stance of the knowing and look at it. What happens to that thought? Don't feed it, don't judge it, simply observe. Again and again. This becomes easier with time. But imagine you're with the knowing aspect. And as a thought, idea or emotion arises from the knowing, look at it. Simply observe what happens. Now ask yourself the question, can one part of the mind look at another part of the mind? Thank you. Some people find this part quite easy, some people quite difficult. Some people, what on earth was all that about? Don't know. So in pairs, 10 minutes. I'd like you to be kind of real about it. How did it go for you? I mean, was it difficult? Was it easy? What experience did you have? Especially in that first one, stepping back, that mental stepping back, and seeing there seems to be a difference between the knowing of something and that which is known. And then what happened when a thought, the second part, when a thought arose and you observed it? What happened to it? Okay? So 10 minutes. Thank you, in your pairs again. Thank you so much.
Do you want to have a talk? Okay. Tell me what you This exercise is a bit like that. That's what I'm looking at. This just gets it gets circular. So when I'm saying that hand drawing itself, does that make any sense? I suppose, I mean, this sounds a bit portentous.
We're in territory where it's a very great thing for me at least. Words don't do the job.
to describe.
Thank you.
Begin to see the gaps. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you've got any eggs or anything, I've got some dry cream.
Thank you.
Which is good for my...
No need to feedback on that. You were feeding to each other. That's enough. That's good. So what the last thing I'd like to say is, you know, just before lunch, is mind is clarity and knowing. That's what it is. But the ego is not satisfied with this. It completely starts to work with I, me, mine. All these conflagrations, right? This is what we do. Our likes and the dislikes. We completely enhance this. Then we exaggerate it and elaborate it to a huge extent. And then we 100% believe that's mind. That's what we do. And not content with that, we then extend it to everyone else around us, all the objects around us, all the people, and all the interactions we have with every sentient being on the planet. That's what we do. Because the ego is not satisfied with clarity and knowing. Completely superimposes I, me, mine, likes, dislikes. Then elaborates it to such an extent until it becomes really good. So it's my elaboration. 100% believe that's true. Then, because we're convinced, we then look at through the world with those eyes. Total illusion. And we see everybody in it, all things in it, and all interactions the same way. So imagine if you could touch the clarity and the knowing of the mind for what it is. What would happen to all these projections, all these likes and dislikes for yourself? And then turn that mind to the world. How would it appear? I wonder. And that's enough to wonder for lunch. Please enjoy your lunch and remember it's silence till just after lunch. Thank you very much for this morning.
Thank you.